Hello, this is Randy Thompson from the Triangle Radio Reading Service. Welcome to Music Review. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. For the next half hour, I shall be reading articles about music from such sources as the New York Times, the News and Observer, The Week Magazine, Rolling Stone, and Entertainment Weekly. Music Review is designed to provide the latest coverage of classical folk, jazz, blues, rock, country, and pop music news. But first, these musical trivia questions. Today's musical trivia questions come to us from the website Revolvi.com and ClassicFM.com. Question number one. What is a luthier? Is that A, a common name for a rambunctious fan at a music concert? Is it B, a criminal who steals private property during a riot? Is it C, a generic term referring to the valves on brass instruments? Or is it D, a term for someone who builds or repairs string instruments? A luthier. And question number two, which of the following is not true of conductors' batons? Is it A, conductors have been using batons since at least the 7th century B.C.? Is it B, conductors in the early 19th century used 6-foot-long sticks to stomp the floor with? Is it C, the earliest recorded batons were made of the tail feathers from birds? Or was it D, at least one conductor has died from the effects of misusing his baton during a concert? So which one of those is not true? The answers to these two important musical trivia questions will be given, as usual, at the end of today's program. Our transitions come to us from the website onthisday.com, and today, quote-unquote, is the weekend of June 29th. Well, it was on this day back in 1956 that Elvis Presley appeared on The Steve Allen Show. He was told not to dance, and Allen had to sing Hound Dog to a real basset hound wearing tails. And it was 58 years ago today, back in 1960, that the musical Oliver premiered in the West End, London.
Sun is hot and that old clock is moving slow, and so am I. Workday passes like molasses in wintertime.
Alan Jackson's It's 5 O'Clock Somewhere introduces our country music news. This is titled, Alan Jackson, He Writes What He Sees. This is written by Allison Bonaguro, published in the 13th of June, 2018. CMT.com. Everybody has a Chattahoochee River. That's what Alan Jackson's record label told him when he was reluctant to release his song Chattahoochee in 1993. Early in his career, according to Billboard, Jackson wasn't so sure country lovers would relate to some of his songs because they were so specific about his life. The label said everybody has a Chattahoochee River. They were right, and the song climbed up to the top of the charts and won the Country Music Association's Award for Song of the Year in 1994. I never wrote a song in my life until I was in my early 20s, he says. That's when he recalls a musician friend from Georgia told Jackson that if he was going to move to Nashville, he needed to come up with his own songs. So I started writing. I do remember in high school I wasn't much of a student. All I wanted to do was get out of school. But I remember in English literature class when we had to write short stories, my teacher always bragged about what I wrote and read it in front of the class, so maybe that was an early sign. I'm a real visual person, he said. As I write and sing the songs now, I pretty much visualize the story. By the time I moved to Nashville, I had already lived a lot of lives and had a lot to pull from. I think that helped. Jackson was inducted into the Songwriters Hall of Fame this past June the 14th.
At a moment like this, I can't help but wonder, what would Jimmy Buffett do?
Funny you should ask, Al.
I'd say, pull me something tall and strong.
Brahms' Piano Sonata No. 3 introduces our classical music news. It's an article titled The Perfect Soundtrack for My Grief, written by Kathleen O'Brien, published in the NewYorkTimes.com on the 22nd of June, 2018. A friend of mine died recently. Judged by the conventional standards of friendship, a stranger might conclude we weren't particularly close. We never met for lunch. We didn't send each other birthday cards or give each other Christmas presents. She'd never been to my house. By those measures, Karen Panacci's short but lethal illness shouldn't have rocked me so. Were it not for this, she was my conductor. I played cello in a community orchestra in New Jersey, the New Sussex Symphony, and she was its music director for 27 years. For 2 hours every Tuesday night, she led us, taught us, cajoled us, amused us, goaded us, encouraged us. We're a small orchestra that others might view as rinky-dink. How rinky-dink? Let's just say that when I joined nearly 3 decades ago, the men still had to be reminded that concert attire meant no white socks. It's the perfect orchestra for me, though, strong enough to play music that speaks to me, yet needy enough to welcome an amateur. We know our limitations and try to avoid playing music that is beyond our reach, yet sometimes my conductor would pick works that were within our grasp, except for a short string of measures that were beyond our collective ability. Whether a wickedly fast run or a riff that was too high or intricate, it was a section we'd never master no matter how much we practiced. When we hit such a passage, Karen could sense the hesitancy and fear that were choking off our musicality. Her solution was to give us permission to fail. It doesn't matter if it isn't perfect, she'd tell us. If some notes fall on the floor, don't worry, we'll sweep them up later. But say something with your music. Why are we here if not to say something? It's an odd job, conducting. In an art form consisting of sound, a conductor contributes none of her own. At its very essence, her job is to make the musicians look deep into themselves, tap into the emotion that the composer is seeking to express, and offer it to the conductor via their instruments. The conductor-musician relationship is as intimate as romance. Some of the pieces we played were so soft and beautiful that Karen would leave her baton on the music stand, her strong hands conducting with the smallest gestures, as gently as if she were caressing silk. When we did write by such pieces, her eyes would brim with tears, and as the final notes faded into silence, she would place her hand over her heart and mouth, "Thank you." Only then would she turn to acknowledge the audience's applause. Its reaction was the whole point of the concert, of course, but before the music ever reached the audience, it was first a private conversation between the orchestra and her. Her final concert last November, when we played Brahms' Second Symphony, Brahms asked a lot of a conductor. He messes around with the rhythm so much that there are times when the only person with the downbeat is the conductor. It requires strength and athleticism. Ominously, she dropped her baton twice during the dress rehearsal. The concert went well. She got through it, hiding her balance problems from us all. Yet the damage inflicted by her undiagnosed tumor was subtly apparent. Someone in the audience later told friends, "Something's wrong with Karen." She was dead less than 5 months later. When we started our search for our successor, we were astounded by the number of applicants willing to move cross-country for an extremely modest salary. When I mentioned my surprise to one of the applicants, he answers, "Conducting is such a fulfilling act. When things go right, it truly makes you feel much greater than just one mortal person. For the finalist audition, we had them lead us in a movement from Brahms' Second. It's my favorite symphony, by my favorite composer. With dread, I realized that when I was preparing for my own chemotherapy sessions in 2009, an oncology nurse advised me not to bring along my favorite music to pass the time. Otherwise, she warned, I might forever associate my cherished playlist with cancer. As we've played the Brahms week after week under the baton of our late conductor's possible replacements, I've come to accept that for the rest of my life, this music probably will remind me of her shocking death. That's okay. It will be an honor, the perfect soundtrack for my grief. Before, I would have described this Brahms as achingly beautiful, and I mostly heard the beauty. Now I hear only the ache.
Love me, love me, say you do. Let me fly away with you. For my love is like the wind, and wild as a wind.
Nina Simone's Wild as the Wind introduces our jazz music news. It's an article published in Jazz Times on the 20th of June, 2018, entitled Nina Simone's Childhood Home Designated National Treasure. House in Tryon, North Carolina, is one of fewer than 100 U.S. locations to receive this distinction. The North Carolina birthplace and childhood home of the late singer, songwriter, musician, and activist Nina Simone has been named a national treasure by the National Trust for Preservation. According to a news release issued yesterday, June 19, the trust will develop and find a new use for the house in Tryon where Simone was born in 1933. Last year, four African-American artists purchased the home for $95,000. National Trust President and Chief Executive Officer Stephanie Meeks said in an article syndicated by the Associated Press that the trust will work with the home's new owners and the community to honor Simone's contributions to society and to inspire new generations of artists and activists. The three-room, 600-square-foot home went on the market in 2016. This restoration will be the first such project to take advantage of the National Trust's new African American Cultural Heritage Action Fund, a $25 million multi-year initiative announced last year focused on preserving and promoting stories of African American achievement, activism, and community. Simone, who died in 23 at age of 70, was inducted into the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame earlier this very year.
Wild as a wind. Wild as a wind. All of me. Why not take all of me? Can't you see I'm no good without you? Take my lips, I want to lose them. Take my arms, I'll never use them.
Frank Sinatra's All of Me introduces our music research and technology article. It's an article entitled Singing Science: Why Do Some People Have Better Voices Than Others? This is published in HowItWorksDaily.com in May of 2018. From belting out ballads like Adele to crooning along to Frank Sinatra, singing is an ability we all possess. We may not all be talented enough to reach the top of the charts, but we can all produce some sort of tune, which all stems from a clever little organ in the neck, also known as the voice box. The larynx is your own complex musical instrument. It contains vocal folds, better known as vocal cords, which vibrate to produce your voice. But the type of sound created depends on a number of factors. The amount of air forced out of the lungs controls the volume, while the pitch is determined by how fast your vocal folds vibrate. A slower vibration will produce a lower note, and a faster vibration will produce a higher note. It works in a similar way to the strings on a guitar, and with the speed of the vibration influenced by the physical characteristics of the strings. For example, the thicker and longer the guitar strings, the slower they vibrate when plucked, thus producing a low-pitched note. Similarly, the thicker and longer your vocal folds, the lower the sound they'll produce when vibrating. This is why men, who typically have thicker and longer vocal folds than women, also have deeper voices. While you may not have control over the size of your vocal folds, you can control their tightness, and this also affects pitch. Learning how to control these muscles, and therefore your pitch, is just one step to becoming a better singer. Why are some people naturally good at singing? Well, no matter how much practice you have or how good your vocal coach is, there's no chance or no guarantee that you'll be able to win Eurovision. The fact is, some people are just born with a naturally great singing voice. The shape and size of their vocal folds plays a part in this, but so does the measurements of their mouth, throat, and nasal cavities. These are the body's natural resonators, meaning they can help enhance the tone and intensify the voice. This is what creates the distinctive nasal tone of some country music stars and the more breathy voice of Marilyn Monroe, for example. You may not be able to control the natural tone of your voice, but you can adjust the style by making use of particular resonance chambers in your body. Anyone can become a better singer with the right training and enough practice. The problem for most bad singers is the inability to imitate the correct notes. Perceiving the notes isn't the problem, because this is how they recognize tunes in the first place. But when it comes to controlling the tension of the vocal cords to match the same pitch, they often struggle. This is simply a case of poor wiring in the brain, but with plenty of practice, the brain can be reprogrammed to give the larynx muscles the correct instructions to produce the right sounds. For many people, inefficient breathing can also hinder their ability to carry a tune. However, by training themselves to breathe by moving their diaphragm, not their chest and shoulders, they can prevent their vocal folds from tightening when they inhale, and air from being forced out too quickly when they exhale, thus having better control over their voice.
Tortured souls repaired by a love of broken things.
Dave Grohl from the Foo Fighters, Statues, introduces our rock and pop music news. It's an article written by John Dolan, published in Rolling Stone magazine on 4/6/17. The Real Lives of Rock Moms. In a new book, Dave Grohl's mother, Virginia, dives deep into the joys and difficulties of raising a star. Virginia Hanlon Grohl was a high school English teacher from 1959 to 1995, but the first time she needed a substitute was in 1992, when her son Dave was making an appearance on national TV. Nirvana was playing Saturday Night Live, and I went to New York to see them, she says. Charles Barkley was the host, and I told my class I'd get him to sign some autographs. But if there were any bad reports from the substitute, then they would be null and void. Virginia, in her late 70s, has attended dozens of her son's shows with Nirvana and Foo Fighters over the years, and was always surprised how rarely she ran into other moms out on the road. So she decided to track some down and ended up interviewing 18 mothers of famous musicians for her book, From Cradle to Stage. They all said, oh, there's nothing interesting about me except for my son or daughter. And then it turned out that that wasn't true at all. In Texas, Virginia met Miranda Lambert's mom, Bev, who used to be a private investigator, including on the Paula Jones case against Bill Clinton. Mike D's mom, Hester Diamond, is a very high-powered woman in the art world, Virginia says. When Mike wanted to be a beastie kind of boy, she was totally accepting. Most of the women who peer are parents of especially well-adjusted artists, Josh Groban, Adam Levine, Tom Morello. One striking exception is Janice Winehouse, who attempts to save her daughter, Amy, from addiction, inspired the singer's 2006 hit, Rehab. The Amy Winehouse story hits close to home because there are some parallels between Amy and Kurt Cobain, says Dave Grohl, who wrote the book's foreword. Like Kurt's mom, Wendy Cobain, Virginia, was a single mother. She writes movingly about her relationship with Wendy and argues that educators can create arts programs that meet the needs of bright kids who don't quite fit in. She understands there are some kids who work outside of conventional systems, Dave says. As for her own son's legendary good nature, Virginia remains amazed. I didn't need to tell him that even when we just had peanut butter and jelly for dinner, he should still say thank you, she recalls. He thanked me every time. Glenn Miller puts us in the mood for our local music news. This is Summerfest 2018 NC Symphony Booth Amphitheater Cary. Jump, Jive, and Swing, Glenn Miller to Gershwin, Saturday, June the 30th, 7:30 p.m., Cary. So how'd you do on today's musical trivia questions? Well, the answer to our first question, what is a luthier? Hint, that's spelled L-U-T-H-I-E-R. Is it A, a common name for a rambunctious fan at a music concert? Is it B, a criminal who steals property during a riot? Is it C, a generic term referring to the valves on brass instruments? Or is it D, a term for someone who builds or repairs string instruments? As noted in the website, Revolvi.com, a luthier is in fact someone who builds or repairs string instruments, generally consisting of a neck and soundbox. So answer D is the correct answer. The word luthier, by the way, comes from the French word meaning lute. A luthier was originally a maker of lutes, but the term now includes makers of stringed instruments such as the violin or classical guitar. A luthier does not make harps or pianos, as these require different skills and construction methods because their strings are secured to a frame. The craft of making stringed instruments is commonly divided into two main categories, makers of stringed instruments that are plucked or strummed, and those that are bowed. Since bowed instruments require a bow, the second category includes a subtype known as bow maker. Luthiers also teach string instrument making, either through apprenticeships or formal classroom instruction. And the answer to our second question, which of the following is not true of conductors' batons? Is it A, conductors have been using batons since at least the 7th century B.C.? Is it B, conductors in the early 19th century used 6-foot-long sticks to stomp the floor with? Is it C, the earliest recorded batons were made of the tail feathers of birds? Or was it D, at least one conductor has died from the effects of misusing his baton during a concert? And by the way, answer D and B are related. The 6-foot-long sticks stomped on the floor, in fact, did lead to a death. Correct answer, answer C. The earliest batons were not made of bird feathers. All the others are, in fact, true. As noted in thepiano.sg, 2016, The History of the Conductor's Baton. In the hands of a conductor, a baton transforms into an instrument of meaning, its movement becoming a form of sign language that conveys musical ideas. Through this language, a conductor and a conductor's baton have an important influence on the way an orchestra sounds. Conductors speak silently to musicians with their gestures, since they can't very well be yelling to the players during a musical performance. And over the ages, many conductors have elected to use a rod of some form to augment their gestures. Traditionally, conductors use violin bows or rolled pieces of paper, as orchestral ensembles were often led from the lead violin or keyboard. The first reported use of conducting staff in a performance dates back to 709 BC in ancient Greece, where a conductor was described to be waving a golden staff. In the 16th to 18th centuries, conductors frequently used six-foot-long wooden staffs to beat time by banging them vigorously against the floor. This posed an unusual occupational hazard, which an incident recorded in 1687 illustrates. Jean-Baptiste Lully, an eminent musician in the Royal French Court, accidentally struck himself in the foot during a performance. The wound became infected and led to his death a few months later. Using one's bare hands to conduct is a feasible, and not to mention safer, option as long as one is able to communicate clearly. Ever since the 19th century, when shorter batons gained popularity, these musical wands have appeared in a predictable assortment of manifestations. With modern technology, the choice of a baton becomes largely a matter of personal preference. Despite its striking resemblance to a magic wand, the baton is certainly not imbued with any music-enhancing supernatural properties. So perhaps one can even consider the baton an embodiment of the truism that it's not what you've got, but what you do with it that matters. Leonard Bernstein is quoted as saying, "If the conductor uses the baton itself must be a living thing." Bernstein argued that the conductor should be reeling in the orchestra rather than acting as a metronome. The way to do this, he says, is to obviously indicate what he wants before it is played. The result, as noted in ClassicFM.com, is that it is fairly common among professional conductors to be slightly ahead of the orchestra. Given the upcoming Independence Day, let's close out today's program with some John Philip Sousa, Washington Post March. Well, we've run out of time for today's episode of Music Review. And as we leave you, remember these words. Kindness is a language which blind people see and deaf people hear. Be sure to tune in at the same time next week. I'm Randy Thompson, reading for the Triangle Radio Reading Service. Content of this program intended for people who are blind and print impaired. You can phone me at 919-832-5138 if you have some suggestions. So long, until next time.